Some concepts, like gender and race identity, are so deeply personal that learning about them from an online instructional video might seem odd. But let's see what it sounds like just for kicks.
My father loves to watch old black and white movies. You know the kind. The woman is at home making a pot roast, and the husband returns from work, briefcase in hand.
This lesson is called gender roles.
Traditional gender roles are those behaviors seen from men and women in those old movies. While there are many differences today, these patterns of behavior have left an indelible impact on society and our thoughts about men and women.
Okay, scintillating lesson. How about race?
Skin color, eye color, food, language, dress. All of these factors are related to the concepts of race and ethnicity. This lesson will look at how these two important categories shape social life and life chances in the United States.
If you're a parent, you may not want to wait till your kids are watching videos like this to talk about how the world sees them and why. But when do you start, and how do you avoid, I don't know, messing them up about it forever? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's what we're talking about now on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 with your questions, conundrums, and really strongly held beliefs about this. 816-235-2888. I'm sitting here in the studio with a round table of parents who all do some kind of work on this topic beyond their role as parents, but we'll get to that. Let's start with Annie Watson. Hi, Annie.
Good morning.
Talk to me about the words you'd use to describe your own identity, first of all.
Sure. So Annie Watson, she, her, hers. I identify as a non-Black woman of color, of mixed race identity, and as a mother of three mixed race children. I usually note in conversation that two of my children are white passing, and one really strongly identifies as an Asian American child.
So walk me through your journey with this stuff as a parent.
Oh, yeah, that's a big question. I think my husband and I decided to have children young. That was part of our life plan, that somehow someday they'd be out of the house and we'd be in our 40s and somehow we might have money to travel, which at this rate is not looking to be true. We were wrong about that. But when we chose to have children young, we also had really strong ideas about the ways in which we were going to raise them. And gender was one of the first ways that we thought we were going to dismantle these sort of traditional notions about the binary structure of gender. And so we have tried really hard to raise our children in a gender fluid and expansive sort of way. And I think along with that has come a lot of unpacking of our own identities in terms of race and being heterosexual and our religious affiliations and choices and the impact that has on our children and the way they see themselves in the world and the way other people interact with them.
Do you remember certain moments early in your kids' lives, like maybe before you were even entirely ready for it, even having thought about these things a lot, where something happened, something having to do with identity, and you just realized, like, this is a moment that's going to put my parenting philosophy to the test?
Oh, that's a great question. So those moments have come up continue to come up more and more as the children get older and now that we have multiple children. So I would say that when we only had one, we were very conscious of everything around this little human and we're very incredibly intentional with the words that we used and the experiences that she had. And then we had the second child. And while we wanted to be as intentional, now we also had to mediate the interactions that these two children had and their experiences being very different. So my children are cisgender. My middle child identifies very strongly as a boy. Despite my best intentions to keep things fluid, he identifies deeply as a boy.
Can you describe that a little bit? I mean, like, moments where you're... Mm-hmm. I have a friend who was, like, telling me that her kid had said to her, Mom, I think you're going to be really disappointed that I'm like girls. Mm-hmm. And he's a boy. Like, she was afraid that she was going to be disappointed that he identified as straight because she had tried so hard to make sure everything would be okay no matter what.
Mm-hmm. And I think we as parents, that's always the fear, right? Is how do we just try to lower the cost of the therapy they will inevitably someday receive? And so in our house, we try not to push one way or the other. We try to keep things even outside of a spectrum and really think of things just broadly and fluidly. But my now five-year-old son would say, the common saying in our house is gender is a social construct. And we unpack that in lots of different ways, but that's terminology that the children use at 3, 5, and almost 9 years old. They use that fluidly. But Henry will fight you tooth and nail as a five-year-old and five-year-old speak that gender is very real because that's part of his identity. And that for him, that is so tied to the fact that his body looks different than his sister's body and that he looks more like his daddy and he wants to be a daddy someday. For him, those things are much more linked than they are for my older child or my three-year-old for that matter.
Have you had gratifying moments of seeing your kids' words or behaviors reflect exactly the things you've been hoping to teach them?
Yes. Yes. I have had equal number of times where I have questioned everything about my life and think that I might be totally failing my children in a number of ways. But I think when I look at my oldest child, because we have had 8 years of really inculcating her into our belief systems, she's at an age now where she's out in the world by herself autonomously more now, so in schools, extracurricular activities. And when she comes home, what we've recognized is we tried really hard just to give her some frameworks for understanding the world. And we see that coming to life now in the way that she is critical of spaces around her.
Can you give an example?
Yes. So last year she was in third grade at a local public charter school. And she came home one day and she said, "Mom, I've noticed something about my class." And that's language that we use often is, "What do you notice?" "I noticed this." And she said, "I noticed something about my classroom." I said, "Okay, tell me more about that." And she said, "Well, I noticed that the children that go and sit in the safe seats are usually black and brown children, and they're usually boys."
Wait, can you explain what a safe seat is?
Yes. So some schools use a discipline methodology called BIST, in which when children are quote unquote not okay, or they're not doing what the educators are expecting, they're removed from the group instruction and placed in a different seat. So they're still getting the instruction, but they're removed. It's a little bit of exclusion. And then if that child is not doing quote unquote okay there, then they're removed and put into a separate classroom. So the educator in me calls that progressive levels of exclusion. But for my child, she just notice this. And so my 9-to-5 is very much in the nonprofit education space. I do a lot of work around school discipline and school exclusion. And so I have all these facts and statistics in my head about, oh my gosh, you're seeing what we know to be true in education systems. But we started to unpack that. I said, okay, well, tell me what else you notice. What happens next? What could you do? What does that mean for you? Right. And so we ended up having this really great conversation and she had enough skill and desire to want to dismantle some of that, to try to unpack some of what she was seeing with her teachers. And I was able to give her some strategies and tools and tactics to be able to unpack that with other children as well.
So that was an exciting moment for you. What leaves you feeling less certain or just uneasy?
Yeah. So I have this conversation frequently with other parents that have multiple kiddos. And I make the kind of crude sort of statement that I'm really just trying to make sure that my son specifically doesn't grow up to assault someone. That I see a level of toxic masculinity in and around the world around him in ways that I'm not sure that I am ever doing enough to dismantle that. Because parenting doesn't happen in a vacuum. And so although I firmly believe that we are doing everything we can to create the right environment in our home, there's a whole world around him that's giving him different messages in ways that I feel like I have prepared or am preparing my two that identify as daughters, as girls, I feel more confident in what I have given to them. And this boy child, I question, and I question that in the ways that we balance conversation in our home. So if any two kids are fighting at any given point, anybody with multiple children, like that's just reality. They're disagreeing. So how do I hold the boy child accountable for the way he consumes physical space, the way that he asks or does not ask for consent, while also honoring the fact that he's five, and do that in a developmentally appropriate way?
Yeah, like kids aren't always gentle with each other.
Yes.
And you're teaching them to be,
but also
they aren't there yet.
The balance for my daughters to have the confidence and the ability to say, stop, walk away, ask me first next time. So in that moment when they're fighting, am I trying to give the skill to my daughters to have the confidence and language? Which am I prioritizing? Because which child, or am I trying to prioritize consent and boundaries for my son? Because which child I go to first gives them the implicit message that one of those values is more important.
And or that one of them is more responsible.
Exactly. And we do that how many times a day when our children are arguing?
Oh, okay. Now let's meet Samara Crawford Herrera. Hi, Samara.
Hi, how are you?
When it comes to your own background and identity, what do you think it's important for people to know about you as they listen to your story?
I am an unapologetically Southern Black woman of color, raising a very strong-willed 11-year-old Black daughter of color in a blended family with my husband, who is a Latino man of color. So highly educated, but also still trying to figure things out every day. That's me.
What are some of the things you're trying to figure out every day?
Well, I think that when we think about how I identify as a woman of color and what that looks like for other women of color, other women in other spaces, how I communicate that to my daughter, who at 11 and is very vocal about her own experiences now, which are very unique than the ones that I had growing up. It's.
Can you give me an example
sure.
of what's different?
Absolutely. So for me, I grew up, like I said, Southern, so very well-defined gender roles. But I grew up in a household with parents who were college educated and had an immense amount of expectations about what their children would experience. Whereas my daughter, blended family, we've lived a little bit everywhere. She can talk to you about Harry Potter as much as she can teach you how to Dougie or do any of the latest dances. That's very different than the way that I grew up. It was very traditional and very, you know, the expectations were extremely high for who we needed to be as children of color.
Okay, so talk to me about your journey with all of this. Like, do you think that there have been milestones along the way in terms of how you think about teaching your daughter about who she is and how the world is going to perceive that?
Absolutely. I think a large part of it was living by example for her and explaining to her that who I am, and when I enter a room, I enter as a multitude of different intersectionalities.
But I'm guessing that's not the way you say it.
Oh, no, no, no. I think
I mean,
that,
at 11, maybe, but...
Ooh, at three, no, I would say that I give it to her straight.
Really?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, that's the one thing that we can do as parents is, you know, obviously you want to talk to children in a developmentally appropriate way, but give it to them straight. They're intelligent enough, they're capable enough to understand those things.
Well, right. But I guess what I'm saying is, what is the developmentally appropriate way to tell, like, a three-year-old that you arrive in a room as a multitude of intersectionalities?
Absolutely. And so it goes back to understanding who else is in the room. And so before I think probably one of the best examples I can talk about as a parent was when my daughter was about three. And she was in a preschool classroom in which she was the only little Black girl. And I remember her coming home and saying, "They will not stop petting me." And I was like, let's get to the bottom of that. What does that mean? And what she meant was they wouldn't stop touching her hair.
I feel stressed out hearing this. So stressed out for you.
Well, and after, you know, you do the calm down in the pantry kind of thing, and you count to 10 and say that you can't go up to the school and get, you know, it was about being able to give her voice to her experience. And so having the conversation, well, why do you think that happened? And how did it make you feel? And is that going to be different than the experiences that maybe your friend who is white is experiencing, or any other young lady in your classroom? And so being able to go in and say, don't touch my hair because I don't like it and you're invading my space, but also because you're making me feel that I'm different because my hair is different and I'm not okay with that. And so that's who we had to be. That's who she has to be as a young lady. And I think that she understands that who she is a tightrope. Sometimes that's actually her language that she uses, is that it's teetering between understanding who she is as a Black woman, or as a growing Black woman, and who she is in the spaces that she enters, and how does she unpack all of those things the minute she walks into a room or opens her mouth.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like a lot of what you do is helping her find the language to put those, like, the way that you feel as a kid. I just have such a memory of weird moments, just feeling weird. I would not have been able to explain why they were weird, but I knew they were weird. And it sounds like you're just walking her through understanding what's weird and finding her own words for that.
Absolutely. I think that that's the best thing that I can do sometimes as a parent, is to help her navigate and find the language to define those experiences. And unpack it in a way with others, that sometimes the best thing I'll do all day is to parent her. In my professional space, you know, if I drop the ball somewhere, that the best thing I can do is to pick it up and how I parent her. And so I think that it's incredibly important to be able to provide that language. It wasn't language that I was given as a child. I have great parents. They're phenomenal. If they're listening, I think they're awesome, but
Are there moments that you look back on and wish you had language like that?
Absolutely. I think I was 17 when our school did the play, and she's passed, in Tozaki Shange's for Colored Girls. And there's a line in there that says, "But being alive and being a woman and being colored is a metaphysical dilemma I have not conquered yet." And my little 17-year-old brain just exploded, because I had never thought about it quite so intensely, and just, wow, that's exactly how I feel. I'm balancing being alive and being a woman and being a Black woman. But that wasn't language that, you know, I had been given to unpack all of those things. And I was very lucky to have attended a historically Black college in which there was a safe space to be able to unpack a lot of those things.
You know, I mean, the story about petting at school really, like, taps into a big question I have. I am Jewish, and growing up, the way that my parents taught me about anti-Semitism when I was really young was as a historical thing.
Right.
They didn't follow it up with, "and it still exists." So the first time I encountered it, I remember it really clearly. And I mean, I was like reduced to sobbing and just really, really upset, really shaken.
Sure.
I'm not sure whether it would have been better or worse to have been prepared for that, to have grown up with a sense that my own identity was somehow dangerous and maybe going to put me. I wonder how I would see my identity if I had been spoken to that way. However, that moment could have been a lot better.
Absolutely. I think that what's interesting is that the same way I taught my daughter to tie her shoelaces, to look before she crosses the street, look both ways, to, you know, seek out helpful adults if she was ever, you know, in an environment where she felt unsafe or she couldn't find me, it's the same way I had to teach her and help her to unpack her race in this country. Because in a lot of situations, in most situations, it could be a matter of life and death. And I, just as much as I wanted her to be prepared in entering, you know, kindergarten, not with, you know, shoelaces completely, you know, untied, or just I wanted her to be able to understand that when things happen, because they will, and they very well can experience, you will have those experiences and want you to be prepared for them.
Well, so we have met Annie Watson and Samara Crawford Herrera. Now let's talk with Nikki Williams. Hi, Nikki.
Hi.
So you know the drill. What are some of the words you feel you comfortable using to describe your identity?
So to describe my identity, I am a cisgender heterosexual woman who is white. I'm married. I have two amazing adult children. And I am a social worker. I mean, I feel like those are all of my identities.
So you are a mother, and I think that part of everyone's experience is so important to this conversation. So is everyone's professional experience with you. I'm going to dive into yours right off the bat. Okay. You are a caseworker with Restart, and correct, you work with youth who are experiencing homelessness, including a lot of kids who identify as transgender.
Correct.
Can you talk to me about just what having a window into the lives of young people who are at a crisis point of some kind, often relating to their identity, how does that affect your thinking about parents and kids and how they interact around this stuff?
Wow. I think that we spend a lot of time at Restart trying to mitigate crisis first. Oftentimes, our young people are not equipped with any sort of tools to be able to process all the things that have happened to them. They are definitely survivors. And so, you know, there are survival tools. But to be able to process the trauma, especially for transgender or gender nonconforming youth who have not across the board, but more than likely have been rejected by family. That's really interesting to sit down and speak with them about how they can move forward within those relationships or not, and create a safer space for them to develop into a relationship with themselves where they can feel confident to be able to make that decision. Am I going to continue to engage? Am I not? Those sorts of things.
You know, people want to grow up for their kids to grow up, to have healthy relationships with themselves and with their families. People want that. Are there big questions that you think that despite wanting that, a lot of parents are not wrestling with, but maybe should?
I think that I am unsure that lots of parents feel the way you say. I don't know that, you know, parents put a whole lot of thought into, I want my kids to have healthy relationships. I think that a lot of us are functioning within our own traumas, within our own historical backgrounds, within how we know how to do things. So first, I would say I'm not sure that, you know, for me, that premise, I don't know how much weight that has. But I think parents, especially white parents, need to do a lot of self-reflection about what those identities mean and what space we take up, and then how then does that translate into raising your kids?
Can you explain that a little more concretely? Like, why would a parent thinking really hard about the fact that they are straight translate into sending some particular message to their children?
I think that from all of my experience with young people who identify as LGBT, if their parents have not done any work in acknowledging like the privilege of being straight, if they don't recognize that that's a privilege, it is very hard to process that potential disconnection they feel from their parents, right? Like, mom wants me to have the big wedding. Mom wants me to have kids. Mom wants me to marry the boy down the street, except I really like Susie. Do you know what I mean? So if parents don't take the time to work on that stuff within themselves, there is this disconnect that just organically happens.
This does bring up that with questions of with all questions of identity that we've been talking a lot about, how you prepare your kid for understanding who they are, but also we haven't talked a lot about preparing your kid for encountering people who are not like them and what responsibilities they might have in that arena. I'm getting vigorous nods, and I'm just going to let our other two guests chime in on that quickly. Annie?
Yeah, so I think, you know, and I think we've talked a little bit about it already, but I think what I have recognized with my children is so critical, and I would say I have the same conversations with educators and with parents, is and what Nikki was alluding to is to recognizing our own identities as adults and the way that we consume space. And giving our children the same framework. So I think we hear a lot of parents these days talking about the desire for diversity, specifically in schools. We want diverse schools. But even in that word, we're diverging from what? From some sort of dominant or quote-unquote normal culture. And so for my 8-year-old, she... in fact, we just did this a few days ago, in which she did another assessment of her kind of personal privilege profile, right? So she identifies firmly as an Asian American child, but she's also able-bodied, and but she's atheist, and she is not really sure about her sexual identity. She says, you know, I'm only 8, I got a lot of time. But she uses the word pansexual because the construct of sexual identity for her feels a little restrictive, right? She's a little bit gender fluid and sometimes uses, you know, pronouns and sometimes, you know, makes some up. And so all of these things push and pull her from power and from dominant culture. And so because in our house, for my husband and I, it is important that our children recognize their proximity to being children of color, it is also equally important for us to recognize that they have other parts of their identities.
Okay, Samara, what are your thoughts?
I think that's Annie kind of knocked it out of the park. Okay. But I think that also if my daughter can really move in close and understand how when she enters space, what comes with that. And I love that at 8, I was like, man, I should have done that at 8. I'm slacking. We didn't do it until 10. About the power profile that she has a substantial amount of privilege. And identifying that and being able to recognize where it's lacking in spaces that she finds herself. And so I think that's incredibly important.
Okay, I'm Gina Kaufman, and we will get right to your calls in just a minute at 816-235-2888. We want to know how you teach your kids about gender, race, religion, all the things wrapped up in what we call identity. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about how we teach our kids about identity, gender identity, race identity, sexual identity, all of those things. My guests are Samara Crawford Herrera. She works for the Kansas City Public Schools, which we will talk about in a moment. We're also here with Nikki Williams from Restart, where she works with homeless youth, and Annie Watson, who does parent education for Turn the Page KC. Also something we haven't talked about. They are all moms, and that's what we've been discussing so far. Hi again, everyone.
Hi.
So when you think about how you're all in the position of not just interacting with kids about identity as parents, but also in your professional life, that means lots of kids from lots of backgrounds who identify in lots of different ways. And Samara, I want you to start by talking about how you see some of these things playing out in schools.
Oh, absolutely. I think that I'm able to be on the forefront of how we talk about equity in schools. And with equity comes the conversations about identity. And I think that how we do things is incredibly important as educators and what we do in the classroom to supplement what is or is not being done at home to create safe spaces for all of our students, regardless of how they identify, what their identities are. And so for me, it means being in rooms with people who are uncomfortable sometimes with unpacking their own identity and challenging them because they do sit in a decision-making space about how that will feel for a multitude of students. And so when we talk about just honoring racial identities, our why? What's the why? How are we doing that? What is the takeaway? What are the feelings? And so I don't know that I get it's on my job description to rebel rouse a little bit, but I certainly hope that I'm able to do that in a space where it provides better opportunities for our students with a district that is incredibly diverse and divergent from the norm.
Can I jump in and just absolutely. Ask you something? So you're talking about what you're filling in the gaps of what parents often haven't done at home. Mm-hmm. What if, I mean, something that I think about as a parent, and I don't know where I land on it yet in all of the specifics, and maybe I will have a sort of meandering path, who knows? But on some level, I do worry, I want to create a conscientious person. I also don't want to, like, pollute him with the ugliness of
sure.
the world as it is. Absolutely, in some ways. Like, yeah. I kind of want him to grow up to be this better person of some better world where these things, you know, and sure. there's this balancing act, right?
It's of, a tightrope.
Yeah. How mm-hmm. much do you tell someone, like, okay, here's how the world's going to see this person and that person? And,
you know, I think it's really interesting that you asked that question. So recently, the country celebrate National Coming Out Day. And my daughter's school really kind of took that on and really embraced it. And I think, you know, for me as a parent, I was like, whoa, we're going to have a lot of conversations, which we did, because at 11, you know, I think that my daughter was still, she's still figuring out, like, well, what does this mean for her? And what does this mean for him? And I'm like, I don't know. You should ask. You know, that's probably, don't ask me, ask them. And so I think that I almost felt like I was like, I wish they had sent tips home for me, even though I knew as an employee that it was happening. I was like, I wish they had sent tips home for parents about how to have conversations following up with that. But I don't think that that was something worth avoiding. I think that it was absolutely something at her age that a conversation that needed to be had so that she could support her friends in their experiences. But I have to say, I don't think that goes back to our privilege a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you get to pick and kind of choose.
Right.
I think that early and often is probably the best type of exposure.
Can you explain a little bit about the privilege of having a choice about whether you address these things or not? Because I'm not sure everyone understands that.
Absolutely. And I think so very often, and I will say this, that, you know, we talk heavily in terms of white privilege, but as a woman of color who's educated, who owns her home, who owns her car, there's a certain amount of privilege that I have. And so just as much as I push back on the narrative of the Black experience in this country, I'm also responsible for what the narrative becomes as well. And so because of that, I have to own my privilege. I can have these conversations. My daughter has friends whose parents cannot because of their state, where they are in their life. If I'm doing nothing more than raising a child that can push the narrative in spaces on behalf of other people, then that's the best way to enter it.
Let's talk to Clinton. Clinton is calling us from the Northland. Hi, Clinton.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I am well. So I had a comment, I guess, that relates to the first guest on your show. And let me give you a little bit of background for me. I'm a 44-year-old father of two. I have a 14-year-old son and a 12-year-old daughter. I was raised by young parents. My parents were 18 and 19 when they got married, had kids immediately. So kind of similar, sounds like, to the background of that guest, as far as being a young parent. And my mother identified as a feminist. And of course this was back in the 80s. So it's, you know, different time, but, She identified as a feminist, and she would come home and relate experiences that she had out in the world. But she used a lot of negative language, language that reminded me. It kind of actually triggered me a little bit when the guest used the words toxic masculinity in the world. So I was raised basically in a household with the belief that men were bad and women were good. Masculinity was bad, femininity was good. And that left me with a lot of insecurities. I grew up with a lot of self-doubt and those kinds of things. And I've tried to never use those kinds of terms around my kids. I have, you know, like I said, I have a son and a daughter. And despite efforts to try and not put them into predetermined gender roles and that kind of thing, they both wound up, my son, when he was young, was all boy. Everything he wanted to do seemed like it was right along the lines of what society would see as boyish, despite encouraging him to look at things from multiple perspectives. And my daughter did the same thing. You know, she was all about princesses and big fancy ball gowns and that kind of stuff, despite encouraging her to participate in things that weren't quite as black and white that direction.
Clinton, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but can I ask you, do you have a particular question or concern that you want to articulate, it sounds like, especially for Annie Watson to address?
Sure, absolutely. I just wanted to ask if she's careful about language when it comes to things like the words toxic masculinity.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's fair. I think, you know, one of the things that parents struggle with is the internal conversations we have as co-parents inside our own heads with our friends and our family about the priorities and values that we have for our children. And then how do we distill that and package that for our children in developmentally appropriate ways at their age level and understanding what we know about them. And so absolutely, right? I would say that my 5-year-old isn't ready to unpack toxic masculinity. I think that is a term that is important probably for him to unpack. But I also...
Someday.
But I also recognize that at 5, I want... I equally want to break down the harmful stereotypes about men and him not being able to feel his emotions and work through those big emotions, while holding space for the fact that as a white passing young child, if he has big emotions when he's at school or when we're out in public, he's not going to be labeled as aggressive likely. And so the biggest thing that I think that I've given to my children is this notion, and I think this is so important for parents to recognize too, and as adults, multiple things can be true at once.
Well, Annie Watson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nikki Williams, Samara Crawford Herrera, thank you both.
Thank you.
In just a minute, the Kansas City-born author of a new book on Jewish identity in a changing America will be joining us. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm joined by the author of a new book called The Jewish American Paradox. In it, he asks this question: if the things that have historically defined Jewishness and that sense of belonging as a Jew in America, if those things are changing, will Jewish American identity survive? And if so, where will it come from, like 50 years from now? Robert Mnookin is the author of that book. Robert, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
So your own journey with Jewish identity has to have started in Kansas City because you are from here. Tell me about that first.
Well, like several of your earlier guests, my own view of identity is that we all have many strands to our identity. If you ask me who I am, I'm a father, a grandfather, a husband. I'm a law professor, and I've specialized in dispute resolution. I'm at Harvard. I was a Harvard graduate. And I'm from Kansas City, and I'm Jewish. And these various strands in one's identity aren't fixed. I'm not an identity essentialist. I don't think any of us is just one thing. And over the course of a lifetime, the importance or salience of any particular strand can vary. Being from Kansas City, it turns out, is a big strand of my identity. I was born there and lived in Kansas City. On Rock Hill Road, not too far probably from where you are.
Yeah.
Until I was 18. Both my parents were born in Kansas City, and I grew up with all four of my grandparents in Kansas City. So being a Midwesterner is an important part of my identity.
Your book opens with a line that I want to read for our listeners because you just get right into it. You write, "When I was 36, I was forced to confront my own ambivalence about being Jewish." What happened when you were 36?
With my family, we were on my first academic sabbatical. At the time, I was teaching at Berkeley Law School, and we were in Oxford, England. My two daughters were enrolled in English schools. They were ages 11 and 8. Well, the first week of the academic year, we were at dinner, and we always asked our kids, well, what happened today in school? And Jennifer reported that she had had a new class called Religious Education, taught by the formidable Miss Kay, who was the headmistress. And Miss Kay had begun the class, Jennifer told us, by asking, who here is of the Anglican faith? Jennifer reported that nearly all the kids raised their hands. She then asked, Presbyterian, a couple more hands, Catholic, Baptist, a few more hands went up for each. And finally, Miss Kay turned to the class and asked, is anyone here not of the Christian faith? I asked Jennifer what happened next. And Jennifer said, well, I raised my hand, and Miss Kay said, my dear, what are you? And I told her, Jennifer said, I'm Jewish. Miss Kay paused for a second, and then Jennifer reported, she said, oh, how interesting. And then she asked whether her parents would object if it is part of the course, the students read parts of the New Testament as well as the Old Testament. And Jennifer said, I told them you wouldn't object, that you let me read what I want to read. Well, Dale and I told Jen that we thought she had responded appropriately, and trying to be psychologically sensitive, I then asked, well, how did you feel about all this, Jen? And she looked hard at Dale and me and responded, when are we going to become Jewish? Now, I responded a bit defensively. Your mother and I have always thought of ourselves as Jewish. We're not really religious, but we are Jewish. Now, implicit in Jennifer's challenge really was the question of what does it mean to be Jewish? Left unsaid, but implicit in my defensive response, was the idea I had grown up with. Being Jewish was not something you needed to choose to become. You just were, whether you liked it or not. It depended on descent. Under the matrilineal principle, if your mother was Jewish when you were born, then you were Jewish. Now, in fact, one thesis of my book is I think in the future, for my grandchildren's generation and beyond, this is no longer going to be true. And I propose a much more expansive and inclusive standard, one that the New York Times Review characterized as revolutionary and, I'm quoting, perhaps heretical.
Well, you know, I mean, okay, so the what's heretical about it is basically that there are movements in Judaism that really take that as just like a thing you don't question is whether matrilineal descent makes you Jewish.
Exactly right. That the matrilineal principle does go back a long ways. But in my research, I learned and others had known that it really was a creation of rabbinic Judaism in about the second or third century of the Common Era. It is not biblical. And indeed, in the Hebrew Bible, the norm was that being Jewish depended on your father, not your mother.
You know, this does bring up what I think might seem peculiar to an outsider about Jewish identity. And I think it's something that a lot of Jewish people at some point or another also wrestle with, is that it is not clear what makes a person Jewish. You can be an atheist and be Jewish according to some people. You know, and there are a lot of people who identify as Jewish and also as atheist, for example. So, like, this question of what makes a person Jewish isn't simple.
It's not simple at all. And in fact, being Jewish in terms of Judaism itself does not require a commitment to any catechism or set of theological doctrines. Obviously, there are beliefs and practices, connected with Judaism as a religion. But Judaism is different than Christianity or Islam in that sense. I mean, for example, you cannot really call yourself a Catholic and be Catholic if you don't have certain beliefs. And the same is true for Islam. That's, as you point out, it's not true of being Jewish. And indeed, even under Jewish law, and of course I'm challenging some aspects of it, you can be an agnostic or an atheist and still be considered, even the most orthodox person will consider you a Jew if in fact your mother's Jewish.
You know, it's interesting to me that, so you challenge several things in this book. One of those things is this idea that intermarriage is this big threat to the future of Judaism and Jewish identity. You propose that that Jewish people need more of like what you call a big tent idea. Can you explain that?
My own view is, and you've just said it correctly, is that in America today, we should have a very expansive and embracing notion of who could count as Jewish. People can express their being Jewish in so many different ways, religious and non-religious. And what I'm very committed to is that in terms of the Jewish community as a whole, public self-identification should be enough. That is, if someone is prepared to say, I consider myself Jewish and I want to be part of the Jewish people, as far as I'm concerned, welcome.
The another piece of terminology that you challenge is the idea that a child who grows up with parents who are not both Jewish, that child is, quote, half Jewish. You question that terminology as well.
No, I and in fact,
can you explain that?
Well, under traditional Jewish law, there's no such thing as being half Jewish. It's really instead something used often in conversation informally. Under conventional Jewish law, you either are Jewish or you're not. And you are if you meet one of two conditions. Either your mother is Jewish or you've gone through a formal and typically very rigorous religious conversion. The notion of half Jewish is often used to describe kids who have one parent who's Jewish and one parent who isn't. But my own view is that ultimately people should be able to decide for themselves whether they want to be Jewish. It should be a matter of choice.
For you, I mean, this is relevant to you as a grandparent, right?
Absolutely. I have two daughters. One of my daughters married someone who was brought up and was as a Jew and was Jewish. The other married Cornelius Alcott V, believe it or not. And indeed, I have a grandson, Cornelius Alcott VI. Now, I'm happy to report, although Corey, his father, Cornelius V, in no sense has converted, he's being raised to have a Jewish identity. He's, in fact, 13, and just this year he had his bar mitzvah, something I never had, because in Kansas City, I grew up in an assimilated Reform family, and Temple B'nai Yehuda at that time had no bar or bat mitzvahs. We were confirmed. My wife never had one either. So, in fact, there are today literally hundreds of thousands of kids who are being raised to have a Jewish identity where one of the parents participating in that process has never converted and is not of Jewish heritage. I think that's great. In America, we're a hybrid society, and increasingly, this isn't something that just affects Jews, but many of us.
How are people responding to this book so far? It's only been out a very short time, but you have the New York Times calling you heretical. Any more informal responses?
Well, the New York Times also recommended it, so I appreciated that very much.
They
it was
like
one
a
of the
heretic.
Editor's choice. Yes, exactly. I guess so. But the responses from any number of rabbis has in fact been favorable.
Well, our time is up, but Robert Mnuchin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Robert Mnuchin is the author of The Jewish American Paradox. He's from Kansas City originally, and now he teaches law at Harvard, so he's done okay. His book is on the shelves now. It came out right after Thanksgiving, and that's a wrap. This morning's conversations were both about identity, what defines identity, how we feel about it, and how future generations will learn about it. You can listen to anything you missed in those conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have them ready for you later today. Tomorrow, voters passed a new ballot measure legalizing medical marijuana in Missouri back in November. So what's that going to look like exactly? We'll break it down tomorrow on KCUR's Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, Chris Young, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.